sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 15th marked the third anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. And like 9/11, things just don't quite add up. There are many, many unanswered questions and what appears to be a cover-up going on. Here with me today to discuss these two events is attorney John Remington Graham. John Graham is an attorney with decades of experience in the fields of constitutional, environmental, and criminal litigation. He served as a federal public defender special counsel to the city of Brainerd, Minnesota. He received both a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. He has also worked on legal issues with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and Jokar Tsarnaev's aunt, who is also a lawyer. Today you'll hear the first half of this interview. Jack Graham, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background as an attorney.
I've been a criminal lawyer now for about 50 years. I was admitted to the Minnesota Bar in 1967, and since then I have practiced over many different states, and I'm also a constitutional lawyer. I have both prosecuted and defended, and I have a background in forensic medicine and science, and I was a founding professor of an accredited law school in my native Minnesota, where I taught about 10 years. So I've been around the block and seen quite a bit of the way our criminal justice system works.
You were involved legally both with 9/11 and with the Boston Marathon bombing. So I want to talk about both of those today. But let's start first with 9/11. Maybe you could tell us about how you first started questioning 9/11 and then how you got involved with the Architects and Engineers.
Well, what happened was that I had been involved in a number of cases involving the presentation of technical, scientific, and medical evidence in court. We call that forensic medicine and science and medicine. And I use this kind of evidence in criminal cases and in civil litigation. And for some years, I worked on water fluoridation, which is a very controversial subject. But I tried three major cases, one in Pennsylvania, one in Illinois, and one in Texas. And the three judges, after long trials, held in either case that fluoridation of public water supplies causes cancer and other ailments in man. Characteristic of this was evidenced by the United States government, which covered up or obscured the meaning of laboratory or scientific evidence or epidemiological evidence showing that water fluoridation causes cancer-related reactions in laboratory mice and is associated with huge increases in water fluoridation of cancer in man. Three judges in a row found that water fluoridation caused cancer, and the Union of Scientists at the U.S. EPA reviewed the evidence, found that the judges were scientifically correct, and so reported to Congress. So I had been through this experience that had covered a good many years, awakened to the reality that the government of the United States is fully capable of cynical use of quack science, detrimental to the health and well-being of the United States in order to promote some political agenda. That was a very difficult experience for me to go through and to absorb without losing faith in my country. But it was not impossible for me to understand that the government of the United States was capable of genocide or something equivalent to genocide, some terrible, terrible acts. Now, on 9/11, I landed in an airport near New York City in Newark, New Jersey, and my plane, of course, was grounded for 5 days, and it was an unforgettable experience. But I really didn't understand what had happened until I encountered some scientists, some architects, engineers, demolition experts, and people involved in related branches of the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and so on, who introduced me to the reality that the buildings on 9/11 came down from controlled demolition. Ordinarily, that would have been impossible for me to believe, except that my experience with water fluoridation showed that the government of the United States is capable of using quack science for political purposes. So I listened very carefully. I then got to know Richard Gage and people who are associated with his organization, which is based in California, but it's formed around a nucleus of now 2,400 qualified architects, engineers, and demolition experts in the United States, Canada, and Europe, who had examined the facts and concluded that the buildings had come down from controlled demolition. And I can summarize the evidence for you. The evidence, and it took me a while to understand this, I can say it fairly fast now, but it took me well over a year and a half just focusing on almost a daily basis. And I had, for a long time, had no opinion on it one way or another. And I was satisfied at the conclusion of my work that there was no other reasonable conclusion. First place, the design and durability of these buildings was strong enough to withstand office fires and aircraft collision, which could not possibly have caused a collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7 as observed on the 11th of September 2001, what we now call 9/11. The opinions of the architects and engineers and demolition experts are impressive enough, but think about it. There were 343 members of the best-trained fire department in the world, New York City, and they know buildings from state-of-the-art knowledge, and they were risking their lives on the fact that these buildings could not come down from aircraft collision and office fires as observed. They had 343 members of the department in there, including their chief, and they were calling up to people on the upper floors and saying, stay where you are, we're going to come up and get you. They had no reason to believe that these buildings were going to come down. And yet they came down in ways which all of us have seen and on television and so forth. And it was really frightening thing. Okay, that's the first thing that we see. The buildings couldn't come down from office fires and aircraft collision. That's a physical impossibility. Yet they did. Second, if you look at each of the buildings, came down at free fall or near free fall speed, symmetrically, each into its own footprint. And that is visibly indistinguishable from controlled demolition. If they hadn't been for controlled demolition, the buildings would have tipped onto adjacent property. That isn't what happened. They just each collapse into its own footprint at a very rapid rate of speed, which means that the inner columns in the buildings had been compromised. And as each building came down, take just the Twin Towers, we have lateral ejection of hundreds of steel beams, clot speed of about 60 miles an hour, and approximately 90,000 tons of concrete, pulverization, midair pulverization of many tons of concrete in midair, and that's characteristic of explosions. At ground zero, we found tons of iron-rich microspheres, which means that the steel had actually melted, and that would require ultra-high temperatures, about 4,800 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just much higher than aircraft collision or office fires could cause. And the steel had actually melted. There was also an international team of scientists who found unignited chips of nanothermite, which is a high-tech incendiary manufactured only by the most advanced laboratories in the defense industry. And finally, we have over 150 witnesses, most of them firefighters, peace officers, first responders, and some journalists who have given statements that are recorded and have been preserved and can be recapitulated in court testimony, where they actually heard explosions as the Twin Towers came down, like boom, 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 boom. And so when you hear that, when you see all these facts, the only rational conclusion is controlled demolition. And those who try to talk around this because they don't want to believe it or they can't accept what it means or they have some ulterior purpose in trying to continue deception of the American people, their arguments don't make any sense.
I understand you were involved legally with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah, well, what we did was on behalf of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is the premier organization in the world, I petitioned the state district attorney in New York City seeking a grand jury and a special prosecutor. We wanted to meet with Mr. Vance nor chosen members of his staff under circumstances of confidentiality that he would establish to discuss this possibility. His first response was that, well, this is a federal matter, which is nonsense because the state of New York has jurisdiction over murder, manslaughter, treason, arson. And so that was not really a very convincing way to brush this aside. And then we came back with further evidence and a second offer of proof where we had evidence of security contracts put out by the New York, New Jersey Port Authority, which had jurisdiction over the World Trade Center and safety issues. And these security contracts were being executed during the year prior to 9/11, and the execution of these contracts would have given those in charge the capacity to provide access to workers who could have installed the explosive. These even included access to elevator shafts. So it was a terrible thing. And another very interesting fact that I haven't really mentioned is that Building 7 came down like the Twin Towers. This steel frame skyscraper was not struck by aircraft. So we know that this could not have been caused by aircraft collision and office fires were sufficient. Office fires are never sufficient.
So where does this stand now with Cyrus Vance and the city of New York?
Well, that was just a typical reaction of all public authority in the United States. Nobody wants to believe it. Neither Congress nor the 9/11 Commission nor FEMA, nor NIST, nor the FBI ever have examined the possibility that these buildings came down from controlled demolition.
So right now it's just a done deal at this point?
Well, all we have is the government of the United States is doing its best to cover this up. The reason is probably easy enough to understand. If the country as a whole or a substantial majority of Americans were able to understand what actually happened, but this was really an inside job. I mean, if there was controlled demolition involved, then there was an inside job of one kind or another. You can make what you want. It depends on how you connect the dots. But we have plenty of circumstantial evidence that would permit a subpoena-driven investigation to find out who the culprits were. And it was found out by the American people and really understood that this was an inside job, that the government of the United States was in one way or another involved, and that Osama bin Laden could not have been primarily responsible. I mean, you know, we talk about conspiracy theories. Well, how could you say that a man in Afghanistan and 19 suicidal fanatics were able to penetrate the most sophisticated air defense system in the world? That is the only conspiracy that is really out there.
Right.
And it's a ridiculous conspiracy theory, abusive of circumstantial evidence. It's a ridiculous conspiracy theory. If you can see that the buildings came down from controlled demolition, then you know that it had to be executed methodically over many months. And that is what happened because otherwise controlled demolition wouldn't be possible, but controlled demolition is manifest from the external evidence that I've just described. If people found out, we'd probably have a revolution, a dramatic, legal, and peaceable transformation, such as occurred in England when Charles I was restored to the throne in 1660, or what we call a glorious revolution, where the crown was transferred from James II to William and Mary. Those are examples of peaceable and lawful revolutions. We would have something similar like that in the United States.
So we have 9/11, and then similar to 9/11, I think anyway, is the Boston Marathon bombing, and you've also been involved in that legally. Maybe you can talk about your role with that.
Well, what I did in that case was I represented the Russian aunt of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the accused Chechenian American boy who was prosecuted and convicted and sentenced to death. And he is now in Florence, Colorado, in a federal high security prison waiting execution as appeals are underway right now. And I represented Merit Tsarnaeva, who lives in Russia, and she is the paternal aunt of Dzhokhar. She is a lawyer. She is qualified to practice in the Kyrgyz Republic, which was once part of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. And I helped her file an intervention asking for permission to appear as a friend of the court. And she laid out evidence which clearly enough shows that Dzhokhar could not be guilty. And that sounds pretty dramatic for someone who reads the newspapers and gives the newspapers and news media of this country any degree of credibility. But the proof that he couldn't have committed the crime is pretty simple. On the 16th of April 2013, the day after the explosions, the FBI crime lab, from fragments at the scene of the explosions, projected that the culprits, whoever they were carrying large, heavy-laden black backpacks concealing pressure cooker bombs that were made from a certain style of a trademark and type of pressure cooker that was marketed in the Boston area at Macy's. And that is clear, that much from the crime lab is unquestionable. No one can challenge it or defeat it. And it was, the government did not just take this as an investigative hypothesis. The black backpacks are incorporated into the general allegations of the indictment, and the government went into trial with this premise as part of their case.
So what are they doing, ignoring the fact that the kids' backpacks were a different color?
Well, here's, on the 18th of April, the FBI came out with what was known as the Whiskey's Steakhouse video, from which two still frames were taken to make wanted posters to advise the public who the suspects were and to solicit support of the public in helping them make an apprehension. You can't tell from the two still frames that were used for the wanted posters, but there's a third still frame which shows Dzhokhar, who is the person accused, from the rear, and it shows that just a few minutes before the explosions, in the same video that was used to identify the culprit by the FBI, he was carrying over his right shoulder a small, flat, white backpack. And so that excludes him, according to the projections of the FBI crime lab, which in turn were incorporated into the indictment. And interestingly enough, and this is not the end of the story, there were photographs at or near the scene of the crime at approximately the time of the explosions showing a number of individuals wearing military-style jackets, pants, and boots, and wearing caps with identical logos, carrying precisely the kind of backpacks which the FBI crime laboratory projected. And those people were never questioned or arrested or charged. And so here we have, going into the trial, a case where the accused was obviously not guilty, and they had made a mistake at best, but I don't think it was a mistake because it couldn't possibly have missed the fact that Dzhokhar's backpack didn't match the projections of the FBI crime laboratory and the general allegations of the indictment. They knew about this, and yet and the defense lawyers could have, on the basis of this information alone, made a motion to dismiss the indictment, which they didn't do. They went into trial, and in the opening statement, Judy Clark, the court-appointed lawyer for the accused, forcefully stated that he was guilty.
Yeah, when that happened, I thought that was really strange. Is that unusual for a lawyer to do?
If you have somebody who is guilty, what you do is you plead guilty and then make a dramatic appeal to the mercy of the court, which is what Clarence Darrow used to do. But you wouldn't go into trial and forcibly admit your client was guilty, then fail to produce the exculpatory evidence, which they didn't do. The white backpack was never shown to the jury. The photographs of the individuals who were carrying large, heavy black backpacks were never introduced. None of the exculpatory evidence was introduced. And in the final summation before the jury, Judy Clark didn't even ask for a not guilty verdict.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
The main facts have been published of the intervention of Merritt Tsarnaeva had been published by Paul Craig Roberts in two articles that he published, and one was on the 17th of August 2015, and another was more recently, the 29th of March 2016. The documents of her intervention were ordered part of the record of the case, and they are accessible. They are part of the official judicial record, and it clearly shows that Sokar could not have been the guilty party and that his lawyers did not make any effort to introduce such evidence. It also includes an affidavit by Merritt Tsarnaeva about her encounter with the court-appointed lawyers, and she did her best to get lawyers who would actually defend her nephew, and how they brushed her aside, and it was not possible to get effective representation for this young man.
Are there people in the legal profession other than yourself? Are there people concerned about this?
Well, I've talked to a number of lawyers, and yes, there are a lot of lawyers who are interested and who see this, but they haven't been willing or able to get involved. When I went to Massachusetts, I wanted to be admitted to the Federal District Court in Boston so that I could assist Merritt Tsarnaeva. My paralegal assistant and I spoke to a number of lawyers. I spoke to the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts. Even they wouldn't come to our assistance. And Massachusetts has quite a distinguished background in the field of civil liberties, so this should not be difficult. I found one lawyer after the fact, whom I got to know, a fellow from New Bedford, who said he was very sorry that this had happened and he would have been glad to have intervened in our behalf if he had known about it, but we hadn't talked to him. But anyway, here we are. We had made contact with literally hundreds of lawyers, and the story was the same. Any lawyer who would have anything to do with helping this young man would have been damaged in his professional standing and would have lost business. So there was a great deal of intimidation. This is a case which was what we would call a show trial. We had the prosecutors, counsel for the accused, and the major news media all marching in lockstep, creating an impression that Sokar was guilty. And they do it by systematic exclusion of the exculpatory facts, emphasizing supposed confession statements which are disproved by the objective facts. So here we are. The legal profession in this country did not get involved because they were intimidated, and that's pretty serious. I mean, lawyers are supposed to be the leaders in protecting men who are not guilty. Here I have been a lawyer now, I'm 75, and I've had the bulk of my career, and so I was able to get involved, and I assumed that I might get involved in a supporting capacity, maybe give some advice, but that there would be swarms of good lawyers that would be wanting to get involved and defend this young man. It was just the opposite. Very striking, because the news media so overwhelmingly deceived the American people on what really was going on in that case that lawyers were afraid to get involved. I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah, that's really very frightening, actually, if they're afraid to do it. Tell me, where does the trial stand now? What's next?
It's right now on appeal to the First Circuit, and I'm pretty sure the First Circuit isn't going to do anything. So the only thing I can do is to publish the actual documents of record. I've even contacted the new lawyer for Sokar Tsarnaeva on the appeal and have offered to send her all the documents, which I had also sent to Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General of the United States.
Now, is this lawyer a government lawyer, or is it one the family has chosen?
No, it's not a family. The family hasn't been able to hire anybody.
Now, how do they get away with that?
If you check out the report of Paul Craig Roberts on the 17th of August, 2015, you will see an affidavit by Merritt Tsarnaeva dated the 17th of April, 2015, where the interaction between the public defenders from Boston and her family are outlined. And you can see, for example, Merritt suggested that the family hire independent counsel to work with them. And they said, if you do that, we'll withdraw from the case. And the government will make it very difficult for that lawyer. He will find life very, very difficult if he tries to get involved. So this is a case, the impression that Merritt gives in her affidavit is that the mother, Zubeidat, cooperated with these, with Judy Clark and her colleagues in the Boston Public Defender's Office in order to effectively betray him.
Wow.
So I have all of the documents. You can look at Paul Craig Roberts' report. You can get it, Paul Craig Roberts, August 17, 2015, or FBI evidence shows innocence. You can Google that. You'll get the report, and you'll see the actual documents that are a public record reproduced verbatim.
So I know on the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, there was a drill going on, and you mentioned those guys dressed up in you know, khaki pants and black shirts, et cetera, and having wearing the hat with the same emblem. And I believe they were from the paramilitary organization, the CRAF.
It is known as CRAF International. And the logo that they were wearing was the logo of CRAF International, which is a paramilitary organization.
Right. So that's a little frightening. And I know most of the false flag events have drills going on. So that, to me, is a clear sign that, you know, we need to look a little deeper into this. So
well, Dr. James Fetzer has published a number of films of the and videos of the event, and you can hear them saying, this is a drill, this is a drill. I'm not saying that I agree with Dr. Fetzer or don't disagree with him about this or some other episode. I'm merely pointing out, there's another very interesting observation by Dr. Lorraine Day, who is an eminent trauma surgeon. She was the top trauma surgeon in San Francisco for many years. And she said that when she looked at news reports of the scene of the explosion, that she made two observations that were very striking. First is that blood did not appear when it was supposed to appear, and as a trauma surgeon, she should know. And that when the blood did appear, it wasn't the right color. It wasn't the dark maroon. It was kind of a bright orange-red kind of Hollywood blood. That was very disturbing. I don't know what to make of that, and I'm not relying on it. But what I do know is that the back sacks don't match, and that therefore the government did not have even probable cause to proceed against Sokar Tsarnaev, and he was not competently defended by lawyers who were trying to get him off. He was defended by lawyers who were trying to cooperate with the government in convicting him.
And again, you were just listening to the first half of an interview with attorney Jack Graham. Please tune in next week to hear the second half of that interview. And to go to Paul Craig Roberts' website, which was referenced in the interview, it is www.paulcraigroberts.org. And now I want to remind you that we'll be showing the film Weight of Chains 2 as part of our Progressive Movie Night on Wednesday, April 27th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. So again, that's April 27th at 7 p.m. And the movie is Weight of Chains 2, What the Corporate World Doesn't Want You to Know. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.